What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff. In a legal face-off, hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there, yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyer's in the house.
Welcome into Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside back in the studio. It's 2016, and we're excited to dissect a bunch of legal topics throughout the course of the next 12 months. We've got the influenza case, Bill Cosby back in the news, some food discussion, Chipotle and Bluebell, MLB players are suing Al Jazeera, and we've got the Inside Out segment later on in the show. But we begin with Professor James Jacobs, professor of criminal law at New York University School of Law, and he joins us now with Rich and Jason on WGN. Good morning, Professor. How are you?
I'm fine.
Thanks, Professor Jacobs, for joining us today. You've written a book, Can Gun Control Work? And obviously this week it's been in the news with what President Obama is trying to establish with executive orders. Can you just walk us through what that process is? And can you break down for us what the executive orders mean?
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. Let me say in the beginning that despite all of the hoopla about the president's speech and his announcements, it's a very, very modest initiative. So modest, you can hardly call it an extension of gun control. So according to the federal law, which has been in place since 1968, if you are engaged in the business of selling firearms, you need a license. And then after the Brady Act in 1993, if you have a license and you're selling firearms, then you must submit the name and identification information of the purchaser to the FBI for a background check. So the question arises, what does it mean to be engaged in the business of selling firearms? And the statute says it means a person who devotes time, attention, and labor to dealing in firearms as a regular course of trade or business with the principal objective of livelihood and profit through the repetitive purchase and resale of firearms. So that's somewhat vague, and the statute also says that it does not apply to a person who is a casual seller or who is selling a small number of firearms from their personal collection. So the president says, and I think quite rightly, there are some people who are violating this law. They are in the business of selling firearms, but they do not have a license, and therefore when they sell them, they are not sending the name to the FBI.
And those, Professor, were it's the gun show loophole that has been referenced throughout the media, right?
Not really. You know, the gun show loophole is a misnomer, because if you're a licensed dealer and you're selling at a gun show, and most of the guns sold at a gun show are sold by licensed dealers, they must put the purchaser's name through the background check system. So the loophole, which is not really a loophole, is that a casual seller of firearms, like if I have a gun and I've had it and I'm no longer want it and I sell it to you, is not a dealer and does not have to put your name through the background check system. And that's true if the sale occurs at a gun show, or if the sale occurs in a bar, or if it occurs, somewhere else.
You know, and Professor Jacobs, are any of these executive orders that he's putting into place, if they were already in place, would they have prevented any of the tragedies that occurred? I mean, I guess the proper question or rephrasing of it would be, have any of the mass shootings that occurred, have they been bought, the guns been purchased by someone through, you know, whatever the improper background checks or whatever the executive orders are supposed to be taken care of?
Again, let me just clarify that the president has not, to my knowledge, issued any executive order. which is really quite startling given all of the media. It may be what he's talking about here is that the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms will issue some greater explanation of what it means to be engaged in the business of selling firearms. But let me just emphasize, it's already a crime, a federal crime punishable by 5 years, to be engaged in the business of selling firearms without a license. So that's already the federal law. Now, to your question, if the problem is to prevent these deranged mass murderers from ever obtaining a firearm, most all of them have obtained them, are not ineligible. There's nothing in their background that prevents them from obtaining, from purchasing a firearm from a dealer, not to mention from on a secondary sale. So no, this would not have affected maybe any, but maybe one of the mass shootings in the last 10 years.
Professor Lotz, this is Rich Lenkov. Lots of gun control opponents always harken back to this idea. We've heard it all the time this week that these measures wouldn't prevent any of these tragedies because criminals break the law. So more gun control laws don't prevent criminals. I mean, I think that's a little bit of a strange argument. It's sort of like saying, why have laws against murder or burglary if people are going to break the laws? I mean, do you buy into the idea that, you know, more gun control laws don't help because bad people are doing bad things?
Well, I just want to again clarify what something very important here is. What is the problem for which this gun control initiative, this very modest initiative, is the solution? Sometimes the problem is that there are these mass shootings, which are horrendous, but very, very rare and very difficult to predict in advance. And then sometimes we shift to the other problem that you're talking about, which is gun crime, gun crime. So, you know, so which of these problems, or is it every, or and there's also suicide, and there's also accidents. So, which is the problem for which this initiative of tightening up the licensing requirement is the solution? So, as far as criminals, it's true. Most studies find that people who commit gun crimes do not purchase their firearms from a licensed dealer. They get them on the black market, or they get them through a friend or so forth. And if you could prevent them from getting a gun in their hands, that would be helpful. But is that really realistic? Did in a country with 300 plus million guns, you can prevent people from getting a gun? Is that really realistic? I mean, we can't prevent people from getting mood and mind altering drugs. To me, it doesn't seem realistic. But you know, we could try.
If mental health problems are the source of all the gun violence, is there any way to detect that in a background check, or is there some system that could be put in place to prevent people with mental health issues obtaining a gun?
Well, we do have that also in the federal law, where it says who is ineligible to get a gun. A person who has ever committed a felony is ineligible for the rest of their life unless their rights are restored. And a person who has ever been involuntarily committed to a mental hospital or who has ever been adjudicated as mentally defective cannot purchase a gun. And that information as to who has been adjudicated that way or involuntarily committed is supposed to be sent by the states to the FBI and placed in the database, so those people will be blocked. The states have been, some of them, very reluctant to send that information. And there's great resistance among the mental health treatment community to provide that information to the FBI.
Professor, I always try to take advantage of distinguished professors and attorneys that we have the privilege of having on our show, like yourself, and this might be slightly off topic, but, you know, same range.
does the Second Amendment, again, I ask this question of lots of scholars, does the Second Amendment really afford people the right to keep firearms in their home? I mean, didn't it talk about keeping and maintaining a well-regulated militia? Do you think that that was what the founders of the Constitution intended when they drafted the Second Amendment, for it to be used in its current state?
Well, you're really asking me whether I agree with the majority or the dissent in the Heller case, and then in the McDonald case, which came out of Chicago. I myself agree with the majority. I do think that the Second Amendment, being placed right after the First Amendment in the Bill of Rights, was meant to guarantee the American people the right to keep and bear arms. The president seems to say that he agrees with that. whatever they meant in 1787, at the time of the Constitution and the passage of the Bill of Rights, by the time of the 14th Amendment after the Civil War, I believe the evidence is overwhelming that the intention of the post-Civil War Congress was to see that the newly freed slaves could not be disarmed by the whites in the southern states. And at that point, the blacks the free men were being disarmed. They were being terrorized by the Ku Klux Klan. And people got up in Congress and said, we have to assure in the 14th Amendment that the free men are free to exercise all their constitutional rights, including the right to keep and bear arms. So whatever ambiguity there was in the passage of the Second Amendment, I think it was clarified or altered by the 14th Amendment. At least that's my view.
The book is Can Gun Control Work? From Oxford University Press, readily available on Amazon.com. And the author, of course, James Jacobs, professor of criminal law at the New York University School of Law. Thanks for joining us on WGN Plus.
That was my pleasure.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is partner at Rice, Downey & Lenkoff and represents Fortune 500 companies and small business and workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2014. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce, Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their continued growth is a result of their aggressive, results-oriented approach that their clients trust. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among our other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN. The following has been a paid advertisement by the firm of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff.
Welcome back in to Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. You can find us on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter, and always be sure to rate, review, and why not, share with a friend. Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside in the studio. My name is Sam Panionovich, and on the phones we have Carol Felsenthal, an author. She's written plenty of book-length biographies. She writes a political blog for Chicago Magazine, also does work for Politico and The Hill, and she joins us now on WGN Plus. Good morning.
Good morning.
Carol, thanks for joining us. We're big fans of you and your column and Chicago Magazine here on Legal Face-Offs. We're honored to have you. You have done extensive work covering the upcoming Cook County State's Attorney race.
The race of the year, I think. The primary, of course, is what counts in March.
Yeah, something
really the most interesting race going locally.
Yeah, something that usually, you know, doesn't get a ton of attention. I mean, usually the Cook County State's Attorney gets a little attention, but usually in the past few races, anyway, it's been Hasn't gotten a lot of attention this year. In March, it's getting a lot of attention, primarily because of Anita Alvarez's role in the Laquan McDonald case, right? You interviewed Anita Alvarez for the most recent issue of Chicago Magazine. First of all, tell us what her demeanor was like. We've seen her on TV. She seems very defiant, very confident. Does she come across that way in person?
You know, one of the things that I've learned over the years, I've done thousands of interviews, is that you never really know a person until you sit down. In this case, it was at her campaign consultant's office, sitting in a conference room, and no matter what preconceptions one has, just watching the person's face, looking at her clothes, body language, it never fails to fascinate me. And so Anita Alvarez came across very self-confident. She looked tired, but she's in many ways an attractive person because of her background and where she's gone and her career. She's a runner, so she's very athletic, very straightforward, although she did have her press secretary in the room listening carefully to every question and answer. The press secretary didn't say much, but she gave a very articulate accounting of her actions in the face of taking 400 days to release video, but she made the argument that she didn't want to interfere with two other investigations, one by the FBI and one by the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District. And she mentioned that she had met with the U.S. Attorney on December 8, 2014, so shortly after McDonald took those 16 bullets. And I said, well, when is the U.S. attorney going to reach a conclusion on his investigation? At that point, her press secretary said, we'd love to know that. Why don't you ask him? So it was a little bit of levity or sarcasm in the course of this.
Do you get the sense that she has tried to distance herself from the federal probe, and more importantly, from the mayor's office? You know, on New Year's Eve, the city of Chicago released more than 3,000 emails related to the Laquan McDonald shooting, many of which, according to some perspectives, show a concerted effort by city attorneys to keep the video from public view. That resulted in thousands of protesters over the last month or so calling for the resignation of Mayor Emanuel, and also many calling for her resignation. So did you get the sense after interviewing her for, I think it was 80 minutes, that she is trying to distance herself from the mayor's office?
Right. She just says, you know, we're not personal friends. We have a professional relationship. And I think that Rahm Emanuel's problems, which continue, you know, there's a whole lot of piling on every day. I just spent probably more than an hour reading the stories calling on Rahm Emanuel to get out of Chicago, get out of his office. You're finished. You're ruined. You need to resign now. There were in national publications such as Rolling Stone and local publications. Well, in these Times is published here, but it's a national publication. But they're more than I can count on 10 fingers. And I think for Anita Alvarez, there was a definite kind of equality in the outrage directed at both of these people. But now it's mostly directed at Rahm. And every once in a while, somebody will say, yes, Anita Alvarez has to go.
Why is that? Why did she weather the storm? Why hasn't Rahm Emanuel weathered the storm? Why do you think, because you're right, you're absolutely right in that the calls for her to resign have died down considerably, whereas the calls for the mayor to resign have increased exponentially. Why do you think she has survived this and seemingly will survive up until the election anyway?
Well, there are two reasons. First of all, she's not a character. She's not, there's, you know, she has a kind of an appealing smile when she talks to you, and when she talks about her family, she's kind of lovely in that regard, but she doesn't have the public profile that Rahm Emanuel has, and there are as many people, probably more people, who despise him, but there's also the people who love him. He's almost a cartoonish character in the way that he behaves, the profanity, sending the dead fish to the pollster, all those stories. Anita Alvarez doesn't have that, but the big difference is that Anita Alvarez is going to face an election in March of this year, and she'll either, the voters will decide to keep her, or they may decide to defeat her. Rahm Emanuel was just reelected. He's got more than three years left to be in office, and I think that is the big difference. And the national media, if you ask the most plugged-in political national reporters who Anita Alvarez is, they might not know, but every single one of them knows every single anecdote and story about Rahm Emanuel. So that's the difference.
How do the other two candidates that are looking to unseat Anita in the primary, how do they fare up, Donna Moore and Kim Fox, against Anita Alvarez?
Well, one of the main themes in this mess of police shootings and, you know, could you believe that after the McDonald case, and there was a policeman involved in the deaths on December 26th, the day after Christmas, of two more people, one an innocent bystander, just totally perplexed me. I don't understand how that happened, but the theme here, the major character besides Rahm and Anita, is Tony Preckwinkle. So Tony Preckwinkle seems to want to play the role as kingmaker. Kim Fox, who is Anita Alvarez's main competition, the third person, Donna Moore, a former prosecutor, now a private a partner in a private law firm, I think is not going to have anywhere near as big a role. But Kim Fox was Tony Preckwinkle's chief of staff. It was Tony Preckwinkle who was very influential in pushing Kim Fox into the race and getting support for her, and importantly, in keeping the Cook County Democrats from endorsing Anita Alvarez, and so making it an open primary. Now, the latest news out there is that Tony Preckwinkle wants to reconvene a meeting of the Cook County Democrats and get that body to, which didn't endorse a few months ago, to issue an endorsement favoring Kim Fox, which would give her a big leg up. Also, Tony Preckwinkle has been extremely important in helping Kim Fox visibility. She will be in raising money for Kim Fox and, of making sure that there are some important people in the city supporting her and holding fundraisers. So Tony Preckwinkle is a key player, and she wants to be a player. So the question is, I asked it of Anita Alvarez, does Tony Preckwinkle want to be mayor? And she said, well, the obvious answer, you'd have to ask that of Tony Preckwinkle. So that's a really interesting factor. The president of the Cook County Board, former chief of staff running, and Tony Preckwinkle's, she doesn't hide it. She's been out there supporting and promoting Kim Fox. And Kim Fox is a really interesting character. The big difference between her and Anita Alvarez is that Kim Fox doesn't have a courtroom experience that Anita Alvarez has. And I think that's what Anita will be running on. So you have in Anita Alvarez both the first woman and the first Latina to be attorney The state's attorney, and Kim Fox is African American, and as I wrote in the interview that I did with her, she has a life story that's extremely compelling. She lived in Cabrini Green for a while. She was homeless for a while. She pulled herself up, got to college, and got to law school, and has had a interesting and important career in the public sphere.
Carolyn, your article, your interview with Anita Alvarez in the latest edition of Chicago Magazine, that's available, by the way, chicagomag.com. One of the most important questions you asked, which we all want to know, is why in the Laquan McDonald case did it take 400 days for the video to be released to the public? I mean, that's something that, and also for charges to be brought, that's something that everyone has asked of Anita Alvarez, and she has given us the answer that I don't think sits well with many people, which is basically that it takes a lot of time. Well, we get it. It takes a lot of time. There was she was working with the U.S. attorney and the FBI, but that's not an answer for most people. Why did it take so long? And I think that goes to the crux of whether people will vote to retain her or not. Don't you agree?
I do. And, her answer, she said to me, and I'm going by memory, she said that's a two-part question. So first she blamed the city by saying that it was the city that was the recipients of the Freedom of Information or FOIA requests, and that put the onus on the city holding back that video. On the other hand, and then she mentioned the other investigations, and the prosecutor never wants to give away evidence before the investigations are completed. And I asked her, what do you think about appointing a special prosecutor? And she was absolutely negative on that, although supported Loretta Lynch in the U.S. Justice Department coming in to do an investigation of the police. So her answer, it wasn't credible, and especially wasn't credible because she charged the Jason Van Dyke, the police officer, with first-degree murder just hours before that video was released. And I said, why did you do that? And she said, because of the sensitive nature of it and the possibility of violence. But so her answer wasn't great, and nor was her answer to the question about the other police officers who were on the scene, and their description of what happened does not jive with the video that we can all see online with a couple of key clicks. And what's going to happen to those officers? Are they going to be charged? And she really said she couldn't answer that question. There were a lot of sensitive issues that she said could not be answered. Also, the question of what's going to happen in the case of the 19-year-old Northern Illinois engineering student who was holding a baseball bat on December 26th when he was shot dead, and the 55-year-old downstairs neighbor in the same building who was inadvertently shot to death. I think one thing we're going to see is the city's going to be paying out an awful lot of money to the families of those two victims as well.
Carol Felsenthal writes on politics for Chicago Magazine, chicagomag.com. You can also find her work at Politico and The Hill. Thank you so much for your time on WGN Plus.
Sure, anytime. Thank you.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have two offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Welcome back, Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus with Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside. It's time for Inside Out with David Sussler, Associate General Counsel at National Material LP, and Tina Martini, who is an attorney, author, and columnist, and a chair of the Chicago Intellectual Property Practice Group at DLA Piper. By the way, they're both married, so that's always fun. How are you both? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. How are you?
Good. David, how are you?
Yep, good. Happy New Year.
So we're going to start with this article, and you guys write, of course, for Chicago Lawyer Magazine. This is an article that was posted back in July, but we might as well look back on it and bring it back full circle. This is about how to make a new you. So I guess, Tina, we'll let you take the floor. How do I make myself a new me? What's the biggest key?
Well, I would say that you need to figure out, first of all, what it is you want to change to, the things that you think you're doing well and the things you need to change. And once you figure that out, then trying to figure out the best way to get there. So, and you also may have to make sure that you're doing it for the right reasons. I think a lot of times people make New Year's resolutions. It is that time of year to do things very differently, but they also put some expectations on themselves that aren't really realistic. So be realistic, be proactive, and realize it's a process. That's what I would do.
So that being said, Tina and David, we've talked with you before about consistency, about hiring outside counsel. Your situation is unique because, as the column title implies, Tina is outside counsel. David is inside counsel. So, David, if you were hiring an outside counsel who you like to be consistent, who suddenly reinvented themselves, what would you do? Is that something you want from outside counsel, or do you want consistency? Or are those two things not mutually exclusive?
You know, they're not mutually exclusive necessarily. Let's say I have an outside bankruptcy counsel who decides to reinvent him or herself as an M&A lawyer, well, you know, that may be a problem because I need a bankruptcy lawyer for this particular matter. But reinvention doesn't have to be that stark. It just, somebody who reinvents themselves may be more of a personality thing. It may be, hey, I focus on something new. I am interested in doing this now. So it's kind of keeping current, being creative. So I like people who are consistently providing me great legal service, but aren't standing still as a human being as well.
And David, you write in the article about your transition from going from defense to plaintiff side and then ultimately in-house counsel. Can you just tell us a little bit about what the impetus was for that? And I imagine that's a pretty extensive process that you went through, at least mentally, right?
Yeah, I'll keep it as short as I can. I mean, I grew up wanting to be a plaintiff's personal injury lawyer.
Boo.
That's the saddest childhood dream I've ever heard, by the way. Forget superhero or firefighter.
Yeah. No, I wanted to be a plaintiff's lawyer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There you go. Save the world.
A family of lawyers. So that was my way of saving the world. I started out on the defense side. I did that for 6 years, and I had an opportunity to switch to the plaintiff side. Worked with a great lawyer, enjoyed it for a couple of years, and then realized one day, I was like, I don't want to do this the rest of my life. Now what? So, yeah, then I engaged on a process of investigation, introspection, reading, talking to friends, trying to figure out what are my options, because I didn't know. I didn't have a plan B after a plaintiff's PI lawyer. But I had some friends who had been in-house and really liked it and encouraged me to try it. So it took a while, and actually networking, my brother-in-law, Tina's older brother, introduced me to the owner of a startup. And we got along, and he took a chance on me, and I very quickly realized, even though what I was doing was completely different than what I had ever done before in my life, I absolutely loved it. I loved the business world. I loved the chance to learn something new on a daily basis. So I reinvented myself as an in-house general business lawyer. And in the process, learned a lot about myself as a person as well as a lawyer.
Tina, you chair a large practice group at a big firm, international firm. You sit on the executive committee. You supervise many associates. What would you say to an associate who came to you and said, hey, I'm just not feeling fulfilled in my current practice. I want to reinvent myself. What would you tell them?
I would ask them why they think they're not feeling fulfilled. If it's because of the way that they structured their life, is it an issue of being a lawyer? Is it an issue of the practice area? Is it an issue of the way that they're approaching the practice? And I've had a number of folks over the years come to me and say, you know, is this all there is? And I've suggested to them to, number one, as they get a bit more senior as an associate, to think about potential niches within the practice, if the practice is something that they're very interested in, and to also look for ways to contribute to the profession that speak to them beyond just practicing law. And that's something I went through when I was a senior associate, was clocking a ton of hours to clients and loving those relationships, but saying, what else can I be doing? And that's when I decided to reinvent myself in a way by getting very involved in the firm's hiring initiatives. So I would encourage them to think about what it is that that fulfills them and look beyond just clocking hours every day.
What is the, Tina, what is the process with a large law firm like DLA Piper if they want to look at, let's say, adding a new practice group, if there's an area that they don't practice in currently? What's the process you guys go through as a big law firm?
Well, we have to take a look at the business case. I mean, first and foremost, we have to do what our clients need us to do geographically and substantively. So there has to be a business case. And so leadership typically looks at, if it is an area that we haven't been in, how best to do that? Is it best to grow it organically from within the firm, or is it best to go to the market and try to hire people laterally who already have an established practice in that area?
David Sussler and Tina Martini with us on Legal Faceoff WGN Plus. The article is How to Make a New You in Chicago Lawyer Magazine. What happens when somebody who tries to create themselves or recreate themselves, when they run into those pitfalls and maybe they have a bad day? David, how would you go about, you know, kind of lecturing them or telling them how to stay on that plane and not get discouraged?
Well, I would take a very similar approach to what Tina just described and have a conversation with them to ask them questions about what's important to them, what are their goals, what do they like and dislike about what they're doing now, what else are they thinking about doing, what else might be out there that they could find to fulfill what's missing and keep that practice going. Ideally, you know, I'd be able to have that conversation with somebody before they decided to reinvent themselves into something new, to help guide them to make sure they're making that right choice at the beginning. And look, not everything's going to work necessarily. Or you do it for a couple years and then you realize, well, I've learned enough here and I realize I want to reinvent again. But I think it's mostly about having a conversation with somebody to help them figure out what is important and of a genuine interest to them. Because it's like what I always tell people is chase what you love. And so I want to help them figure out what that is.
Tina, do you think that practicing law is unique in that it does make people want to change courses quicker than other professions? Do you think that people get burnt out performing law? We've had that topic discussed here on Legal Faceoff before. Do you think people want to reinvent themselves quicker after practicing law for several years in other professions?
Great question. I think there are probably some other professions where I've seen people change course pretty quickly. I've seen it happen in the medical profession. Sometimes when people actually don't even start being a doctor, they change course in the middle of school. I've also seen it in the accounting profession as well as the consulting profession. And I think it's one of those things where you have to figure out why is there this trend. And I think it's a couple reasons. First, I do think there's a burnout factor. But I also think sometimes people choose professions like the law and other service professions for the wrong reasons. And they realize it pretty quickly when they're in the trenches that it's a very intense career. It's something that can be very fulfilling. But if you went into it for the wrong reason, then I think oftentimes we see those folks taking a different course more quickly than maybe some others.
Well, here's the million-dollar question that maybe we'll go around the room on this one as we start a new year. What's the one thing you would change about yourself? I want to reinvent myself. I'm going to go Urlacher and maybe get some hair in 2016. Sammy, what would you How would you reinvent yourself in 2016?
I would like a better wardrobe.
Yes.
Sitting with the four of you and looking at what I wear sometimes. You know, I look like I came out of prison. So I would probably like a little bit better threads.
Yeah, but you could carry. You're young. You're not old and tired like us. I mean, we have to make up for our old age with some,
right.
You know, something. So,
what about you, Whiteside?
You know, we're actually, professionally, we're actually going through a process right now of adding a new practice group. So it's kind of exciting. We're going through the research on it. And so this article is pretty prompt for us. But
you're going to unveil that breaking news on Legal Face-Off, it sounds yeah. like, at some point.
You know, it's a long – I appreciate what David did, you know, in switching gears like that, because adding a new practice group is definitely – it's something that's uncomfortable. It's a different area. But it's also exciting, too, because, you know, as a law firm, it can expand our revenues and, you know, take us to another level. So it's exciting, but also, too, it's new territory, so we don't know what to expect. But so I don't have any personal change. I do want to add more hair to my head, too. But I don't know if I can get any more on there.
Yeah.
Tina?
Well, professionally, I stepped into being the chair of the Chicago IP Group relatively recently. So for 2016, I'd like to see us continue to increase our revenue and grow that practice. And then personally, I'd like to make it to more Cubs and Hawks games.
No White Sox games.
Sorry. No, we don't say those words in our house.
Well, I'm going to say them here then. David? Go ahead, David.
Well, you know, professionally, I think the reason I love what I do now is I'm kind of reinventing myself every day because I get to do so many different things and things I've never done before. And personally, well, I could agree with Tina and want to go to more, especially Hawks games. But I'd have to say what I say year after year is become more dedicated to exercising, which is a never-ending battle for me.
It's like when you go to the gym and it's loaded up, right? The first 2 weeks of January.
Yeah.
And everybody
just stay away the month of January. Everyone's there.
Everybody just trails off.
Yeah.
So what is something, and maybe you can both answer this in a different way, but what is one of the pieces that's sort of on the docket that you haven't written that maybe is on the back burner that you're looking forward to writing next for Insight? Anything specific, anything that you're kind of spiraling back and forth on?
I'm happy to kick that one off, David. I would say that we're really looking forward to writing about things like innovation. I mean, I think that's something we're hearing a lot about in this profession, and it's something that a lot of folks don't really understand what that means in the context of a service profession, particularly the law. Everybody sort of knows what it is with respect to products. But I think that's what we're seeing as part of the natural evolution of the profession is taking concepts and ideas that have often been applied in the products area and thinking about ways to leverage that expertise and that knowledge into the services profession, because we just have to be leaner and meaner. I mean, that's what our clients are expecting. So that's one area that I think we're going to be exploring quite a bit, particularly in the next couple of months.
Well, before we let you go, we're going to cover the Netflix series Making a Murderer here in a few minutes on The Grab Bag. Are you both watching it? And if you are, don't spoil it. I'm only at episode 4, but are you watching this as a couple? And if so, I have a dilemma in my house because I'm trying to watch it with my wife, but we're on different paces, so I'm doing a little Netflix cheating on her. Do you guys have the DVR cheating problem?
We haven't started on that series yet. I've been reading about it lately. We do share some series that there have been occasions where I'm out of town and Tina will cheat and watch it without me. And
that's such a big issue.
It goes two ways.
Breaking news.
Inside Out column disbanded due to DVR cheating.
Is this going to be like The Replacements breaking up on stage about 25 years ago?
What's the best legal show that you guys, what's the best all-time legal show? David?
The best TV show?
Yeah.
Well, L.A. Law was great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, L.A. Law was the best. Arnie Becker was your personal hero, I remember. Tina, what's your favorite legal show of all time?
Well, I love L.A. Law also. I would have to also say that Ally McBeal was terrific. It came out right around the time I started practicing, and so I think every woman who was a relatively junior attorney around that time sort of identified in some shape or form with Ally McBeal. So,
the dancing baby.
Yes.
True to life.
You could submit your ideas or your questions insideout@gmail.com. David Sussler and Tina Martini, they are married, they are attorneys. I don't know when they sleep. And they also write for Chicago Lawyer Magazine, chicagolawyermagazine.com. Happy New Year. Thanks for coming in.
Happy New Year. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys.
Happy New Year. Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Be sure to listen to Legal Face-Off on iTunes. Search for Legal Face-Off. Facebook, you can find us, Legal Face-Off. Follow us on Twitter, at The Legal Face-Off, as we welcome you into the grab bag. Rich Lankoff and Jason Whiteside on WGN+. We'll start with the affluenza teen's mom, who appeared in Texas court today for arraignment.
Yeah, the story of Ethan Couch has been all over the news, with him and his mommy taking a nice Puerto Vallarta vacation down to Mexico, even though he was convicted of killing two teenagers and severely injuring another in a car accident.
By the way, weren't you just in Mexico? Is there a connection here somehow?
No, I was far away from
Puerto
Vallarta.
Were you sheltering these two in Mexico?
Well, you know what I love, too, is they were trying to hide out, and they both have, like, bright red hair, and he wore the same little, like, dingy 16-year-old mustache and a beard.
It's the Clark Kent theory of disguising. Wow, you're going to wear glasses, Superman? Wow, yeah. I can't tell who you are.
Use the comic book disguise. Yeah. So, anyway, they were caught, surprisingly, and he's now sitting in a Mexican jail and fighting extradition, so he's going to do a little more time down there. And one of the articles said that he's in a not-so-nice neighborhood in a very nasty prison.
Wah, wah, wah.
The mom got pulled back into California and is waiting extradition out to Texas to face the judge out there. So still going strong with the affluenza teen.
A couple of interesting legal questions are, you know, he hired a high-powered Mexican attorney who is fighting the federal government's efforts to get him back to Texas. He's saying that they're trying to deport him rather than extradite him. Generally, you extradite someone for a crime, but it takes a little longer. They're saying that the feds are trying to circumvent that process by deporting him. Does anyone get why you would want to sit in a Mexican jail rather than, you know, go home to Texas? It's important to remember he is facing a charge of missing a parole meeting, which
he's not facing any more jail time. All he's facing is just that he's going to go back. He's going to get another slap on the wrist, and they're going to tell him the next time he does something, it's going to be 10 years per occurrence.
Right.
So, and
if he goes, so yeah, that's true. The worst case scenario is he'll face 120 days in jail. That's only if they're successful in moving the case from juvenile to adult court. If they could do that, he gets maybe 120 days in jail. So why would you be fighting that? Why would you want to sit in some decrepit Mexican jail rather than come back to what, you know, face 120 days in jail at most?
Better
food.
Makes
no sense.
Better food.
Yeah.
I don't see any benefit at all. I mean, and come back to the U.S. too, where your parents obviously have a lot of money to try and maneuver the legal system properly.
Maybe he doesn't know right from wrong anymore. Maybe he still doesn't know.
Maybe this is their whole defense with the affluenza teen.
Yes. I mean, we were talking about this a bunch this week. Just one of the most ridiculous defenses, right? I mean, everyone agrees that this affluenza is complete nonsense, proving again the point that you could find an expert to say anything.
Yeah, and my thought, too, was if they're going to blame the parents for this incident, then why aren't the parents being the ones that are held accountable?
Well,
if you're going to get a defense for affluenza, and the judge actually bought it and said, all right, fine, we're going to reduce the sentence, then why are the parents not held responsible for his actions?
Yeah, well, I mean, ironically, the mom is actually facing the biggest criminal charge. She could face between 2 and 10 years for impeding the return of him.
Well, and the father, interestingly, too, did not hide their whereabouts. And when authorities questioned him, he was very helpful in locating them. So I have a feeling that maybe mommy is the one that's helping the Ethan Couch become affluenced, if that's a word.
Affluenced.
We'll look it up. So just before the ball dropped on 2016, Bill Cosby was charged with sexual assault in Pennsylvania. Warrant for his arrest was issued. He will remain free on $1 million bail, actually, until the trial. But we'll have more and more news sort of seep out. We have news this week.
Yeah, the news that's going on this week is with regard to his wife, Camille, who we've seen at various stages of this this story, and the news this week is she was subpoenaed to testify in a Massachusetts civil case that was brought by three accusers who accused Cosby of defamation, basically saying that because he denied their claims, he was defaming them. He, of course, has countersued them. And stemming from this Massachusetts civil case, they want to depose Camille to know what she knows about all of this. Well, she successfully got the deposition continued, alleging that the marital privilege prevents her from having to testify. So the marital privilege, as we probably all have heard, is between a husband and wife. It's similar to an attorney-client, doctor-patient, clergy privilege that says that communications between a husband and wife that occurred during the course of their marriage are privileged and therefore non-disclosable. She's saying that she shouldn't have to testify against him in the civil suit because they're married. But the exception, there are many exceptions to that privilege. Exception in this case is likely that she was also his manager, and because she held that dual role, then she should have to testify as in her position as manager. What do you guys think? Should she have to testify? Is the marital privilege always, should that always hold?
I would hope that the marital privilege always holds. I mean, I think that there's things that, you know, spouses
relate to. Something you want to tell us?
I'm going to carefully couch my words now, but I think that there's things that spouses tell each other that, you know, might come up, and it might be innocent, and it might, you know, lead to some implications further down the road. So and I think that's the whole basis for the marital privilege, too, is that it does. There's such a relationship, and there's, you know, some trust there. So it's whatever said should remain between the two spouses.
You should be protected, though, right? Usually you're protected by that marriage.
You are, but like in this case, I mean, there's obviously exceptions to every privilege. In this case, the exception would be that she served this dual role as the manager. When she stepped out and served the role as a manager, then the privilege is gone. The federal court judge of Massachusetts agreed that the privilege was waived. He ordered her to appear for the deposition. She's appealing that. So I think I don't think the privilege will hold in this case, but we'll see.
Yeah, the other other angle with the Cosby case this week, too, is that the Los Angeles district attorney decided not to press charges, criminal charges, against Bill Cosby for two rape cases, basically saying that too much time had passed and the statute of limitations had expired. So one of them was the female at the Playboy Mansion, Chloe Goines, who alleged that Bill Cosby sexually assaulted her in 2008. But first of all, there was a lack of evidence that they were ever at the party together, and two, too much time had passed. So prosecutors said they're not going to charge him criminally in that case.
Chipotle Mexican Grill, Bluebell Creamery's both under fire for selling contaminated products, making customers sick. It was E. coli with Chipotle in Denver. Then in Texas, there was Listeria found in Bluebell's ice cream, which actually led to three deaths. I feel like the legal fallout is just getting underway for these two companies.
Yeah, we've covered on this show extensively the trend by the federal government to go after more aggressively companies that they feel have done some wrong to the public. They've gone after not only these companies, but the, you know, CEOs individually, which is very unusual. Chipotle, since this foodborne illness outbreak, there's been some civil lawsuits. There is a 43% drop in their stock price in the last 3 months. Now they've been served with a federal grand jury subpoena as part of a criminal investigation of the neurovirus outbreak in California. The subpoena calls for Chipotle to hand over a broad range of documents. I think federal investigators are going to look into a couple different angles. They're going to look into emails between the restaurant and corporate headquarters to see what was known, and also the immigration status of the staff of this restaurant that may have caused the outbreak. What's interesting legally is they're going after them. They'll be charging them potentially with a felony, which is really unusual in this kind of foodborne illness case. For the felony charge to stick, the prosecutors will have to show that Chipotle or its employees intended for this food to be served knowingly, that they, you know, wasn't just negligence, but they knowingly caused it to be served. This is sort of similar to that Peanut Corporation of America case where the CEO was given a 28-year sentence for knowingly shipping salmonella-tainted peanut butter that killed 9 people. So, again, the federal government, which I think is a good thing, is more aggressive with prosecuting these kind of cases, and the Bluebell situation is similar.
Yeah, there was a memo issued in September 2015 by the Department of Justice. They call it the Yates memo because it came from Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates. But she announced that the department was going to focus all future investigations on the culpability of individuals and not necessarily just the corporation. So that's probably the reason for the uptick in the amount of executives that are focused on, especially in the Chipotle and the Bluebell company instances.
Yeah, I mean, I know Jason has had cases against restaurants for these kind of situations. I defend a lot of restaurants for alleged foodborne illness. When the federal government takes it to the next level and goes after individual members of the corporation, it certainly has a lot more power. And again, in cases where corporations like the Peanut Corporation of America, there's evidence that they knowingly deceive the public or knowingly
ship
product
anyway.
Regardless. I mean, yeah, it's quite appropriate to do that.
Does this different... just end with a big check? Is that the end game here?
No,
for
these are criminal charges that the Department of Justice is going after right now with Bluebell and Chipotle, just like in the Peanut case. So, no, I mean, there will be monetary fines issued by the government, but when the Department of
Jail,
when the Department of Justice gets involved, all they're after is they're looking for criminal charges, felonies, misdemeanors, jail time. The monetary side will be, you know, the Food and Drug Administration that'll take care of that.
Al Jazeera America, still in the headlines. Washington Nationals first baseman Ryan Zimmerman, Philadelphia Phillies first baseman Ryan Howard are suing Al Jazeera for defamation after a report in December linked them to a doping ring.
Yeah, we all heard about this Al Jazeera America documentary called The Dark Side that implicated Peyton Manning's wife. Peyton Manning has come out and threatened legal action, obviously saying that the accusations are false and any implication to him are false. Two people, Ryan Howard, Ryan Zimmerman, actually have gone the extra step and filed. What's interesting, legally, of course, that's always our goal on Legal Face-Off, is they filed defamation suits. These cases are really hard to win. That's why you don't see more celebrities filing them. You know, every time you see a headline in National Enquirer, they're very hard to win. They're very costly. And most importantly, they have to disprove something. An absolute defense to a defamation or slander case is that it's the truth. So if Al Jazeera proves that there is some truth to it, that's an absolute defense. Well, if you're the plaintiff, like Ryan Zimmerman, you have to sort of disprove that.
It's like a double negative.
Right.
Yeah.
You have to prove that you weren't taking performance enhancing drugs, which, you know, who wants to air that in public? It's very expensive, very hard to win. So
there's a lot of the players, too, that were implicated in the news report from Al Jazeera that even came out and said, I talked to my attorneys. They told me it's a waste of money and a waste of time, so we're not doing it. James Harrison was one of them, and he said it's not worth it. I know the truth. So, but that whole report has kind of died down in the last week, too. No one's heard anything about it ever since the guy at the Indianapolis pharmacy, the pharmacy intern, said, okay, I made it all up. It's not true. So it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
Well, maybe a quick segue now that we have the world's foremost sports expert, Sam Panionovich, with us. You know, talk about performance-enhancing drugs in baseball. We just came off the Hall of Fame voting where Piazza finally got in. Do you think this signals a change in the voters? Do you think that mere allegations or whispers of performance-enhancing drugs are no longer going to preclude people from being in the Hall? I mean, Piazza was never even convicted, never really talked about it. It was just whispers that he took drugs. Now he's in. Pudge Rodriguez is up next year on the merits. One of the best catchers ever, but he also was always sort of talked about as taking PEDs. How does that affect him? What about Bonds? What about Sosa? Sosa got like, what, 12% this year?
Sosa had 6 or 7%, and you have to have 5 to just stay on the ballot. You bring up Piazza, connected but not convicted. And that's really the big key with all these guys going forward. It was an uptrend, though, for Bonds and Clemens. They got more votes this year. And did you guys catch that they're trying to phase out old voters, some of those old guard voters that leave empty ballots and so on and so forth? They're trying to bring in new voters who grew up with the steroid era. And baseball is supposed to be a museum where you recognize the good, the bad, the ugly. And for these guys, two of the best players of all time, even before they ever put anything in their body, they were Hall of Famers.
Yeah, so it seems like the what term did you use? Not convicted?
Connected, not convicted.
So it seems like that class of people are in, right? So the Pudges, the Piazzas. The next question is the guy. But when you think about it, Clemens and Bonds were never convicted. I mean, they were implicated a little bit in, you know, the Balco thing and the Mitchell report. But why wouldn't Clemens and Bonds be in if Piazza's in?
That's a good question. I think the new trend is if you weren't caught while you were playing, you are given more leeway. Like Alex Rodriguez, suspended during his career. Manny Ramirez, busted twice.
I mean,
twice.
Ramirez will never. I mean, can you imagine? I mean, Ramirez was busted twice, as you said. I mean, I think that.
While they were playing, though. Yeah. That's... Because Bonds, we filled the stadiums. We went to batting practice. We cheered him. And then once he retired, he cut his legs out.
What do you think will happen with Alex Rodriguez then?
Never get in? No chance.
Yeah, but I mean, that speaks to the old guard mentality, right? So even though he was convicted, it's a museum, not, you know, a place to hold people to high regard. So you're right. I think he won't get in either because it's, you know, him and Manny Ramirez were, you know, actually took it and were suspended. But maybe as the younger voters, you know, come up, they will allow guys like that in.
You just have to imagine that everybody was taking something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
During that era.
And you know, it's so precious too, the difference between like these people that'll take there's all these herbal supplements that come out, you know, that they take that are on a ban list somewhere, they become on a ban list that weren't on a ban list before. I mean, the NFL has it too, where, you know, players have to go to the team doctor now just to say, all right, is this something that I can put in my body, even though it's not a steroid, it's still in the performance enhancing category. So yeah, there's a broad category of those drugs.
When are we up for the legal Hall of Fame?
The radio legal podcast Hall of Fame?
For sure.
Pud Galvin used to pitch in the late 1800s. He used to take sheep testosterone. He is in the Hall of Fame, by the way. So we'll leave it at that. And we wrap up the legal grab bag, legal face-off on WGN Plus with Making a Murderer. No, we're not going to give you tips. It's a show that was released on Netflix. I haven't seen it yet. Are you guys both avid watchers?
It's breaking
not
the internet,
yet.
This show. I just picked up on it a couple days ago. I am in the middle of episode 5, so we're not going to spoil it for anyone. Probably by the time most people hear this, they'll have either binged or never heard of it. But for the next Legal Face-Off, we're going to try to get a panel together with some of the reporters who are involved, and you know, maybe a couple of the attorneys if we get lucky. Yeah, it's a really compelling documentary on Netflix. It's about Steve Avery, who was initially convicted of a crime in Wisconsin, served 18 years, then was exonerated by DNA, and the show picks up with him being arrested again, this time for murder, and the story is about the trial and whether he was framed by the same system that put him behind bars the first time. So if you believe the documentary, he was set up and lots of evidence was planted. I am in the middle of it, so I don't know if he was convicted of the murder. Jason, I know that you like to spoil things for everyone, so it's certainly out there in the media, but I don't know. I'm watching the show in real time. I'm 4 episodes in. So for the next Legal Face-Off, we're going to try to put a panel together with some of the reporters, maybe some of the attorneys. You guys aren't watching it yet?
Nope, never will.
No, I'll never probably will. Watch it. But
not a binge?
Nah.
Too many Ren and Stimpy's on the DVD?
too many Pokemon episodes I got to get to.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll watch it this weekend since we're supposed to have some beautiful Chicago weather.
Yeah.
Stay indoors.
It's a good binge for sure.
Thanks to our guests. Thanks to you for listening. For anything you may have missed or past episodes, WGNplus.com. We'll see you in 2 weeks on Legal Face-Off.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.